Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I sit down with fascinating people to explore their passions, pursuits, and points of view. And today's episode is about an extraordinary adventure, one that began later in life, and yes, it involves Bruce Springsteen. My guest, Ann Able, has captured this journey in her powerful memoir, High Hopes. It's a story of unexpected turns, life-changing experiences, and the courage to follow where the music leads. You can find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for more about Ann and her work, go to annableauthor.com, annableauthor.com, and follow her on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks. The journey that you took started at a later age and a later stage in life, I should say. It wasn't in your teens. It wasn't in your 20s, 30s, etc. What got you off the couch and all of a sudden you're going to a concert, which I was shocked that you had never been to a concert. I thought maybe at least a Glenn Miller concert, but no, nothing.
Nothing. No, I had, at the age of 59, I had never been to a concert. My parents didn't approve of music or fun. As a matter of fact, in 1964, when 73 million people tuned into the Ed Sullivan Show to watch the Beatles, 12-year-old me was not one of them. My mother saw me turn on the television and she said, "It's a waste of time. Go to your room and do something constructive."
Amazing.
Then, when at the age of, and I suffer with severe depression, I have had ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, 3 regimens. I'd been hospitalized inpatient twice. And I mean, I just really, really, really suffered.
Well, I have a question for you, Ann. As your therapist or your online therapist or for the day or this half hour, you don't present as a depressed person in terms of your energy, in terms of your delivery. I'm fascinated by the fact that you actually had to go through all of that and then were still able to lead an adventurous life and continue to do so.
Well, first of all, not to get to the punchline yet, but okay. It all started with this concert at the age of 59. And this trip that I went on a year later, and I'm jumping way ahead here. I did not go to change. Let's go back. Okay. So I'm 59. And Labor Day weekend 2012, my son calls from Boston. We were in Philadelphia, and he said he wanted, could they come to visit us in Philadelphia that weekend? And I was thrilled. I mean, that was the thing that gave me, that was the one thing I loved was my family. And I said, well, of course, you know, I was feeling sorry for us. We're not doing anything fun this weekend. And then he said, well, we're going to a Bruce Springsteen concert on Sunday. Do you want to go? Well, this was all through my husband. My husband was on the phone. And I said, why would I want to go? First, I'm sure I'd heard of Bruce Springsteen. I mean, I'm sure. And I probably even knew he was a rock star. But other than that, I knew nothing. So I said, no. And meanwhile, he said to me, can Kyle, that's his wife, bring her wedding gown? They had gotten married 6 weeks earlier in the middle of my 3rd regimen of ECT. And that treatment had to be stopped because I was losing my memory. So I did not remember their wedding from 6 weeks earlier. So she was going to bring the wedding gown so I could see it. So great, they come, they show up the next day. I'm thrilled. And they bought 2 tickets. And then Sunday morning, the only thing that ever helped me with my depression was working out. And sometimes it would only help for 5 minutes, sometimes 10, sometimes a few hours. But one thing about me, I will do anything if I think it will help me. That's why I had ECT 3 times, all these terrifying things. I just did them hoping to feel better. So Sunday morning, I get up really early to exercise. So I'll be there when my kids wake up. And as I'm exercising, and that's when I just feel my best. And my husband had put Golden Oldies, because that's what he likes, on my headset. And I thought, you know what? I want to go to this concert because I want to spend time with my kids. So I finish my workout. I go running in. They're sitting on the couch looking at their phones. And I tell them, and they looked a little startled. But anyhow, we gave away those 2 tickets. They got tickets for us. We get to the concert and we're sitting there. And again, they're showing, you know, I didn't remember their wedding. So we're sitting there and they're showing, telling me stories about the wedding, showing me pictures. And it felt so good. I felt so good and content to be able to share these forgotten moments with them. So good and content that it wasn't until the crowd mysteriously rose in unison that I realized we had been looking at pictures and talking for 2 hours. And then as if the energy of the crowd pulled me up, I stood up and I looked up at the Jumbotron, the giant screen, And there was the face of a man with the biggest, kindest smile I had ever seen. And my heart just opened up. And for the next 3+ hours, that man's energy, humanity, and enthusiasm lifted me. For 3+ hours, Bruce Springsteen made me feel like I had a chance. He made me feel alive. And the following Saturday, my husband and I went to Chicago to see him at Wrigley Field. And for the rest of the fall, I went to 3 or 4 more concerts if I could drive there or get to them. And then a year later, fall 2013, I've been teaching at the Community College of Philadelphia for 5 years. I loved it. It's what it was. It gave me a purpose. I really loved it. But this year, I had the 5th week of the semester, this one day after having one desk too many thrown at me. I mean, really desks thrown at me. I just walked out the door and I thought, I deserve better than this. I'm never coming back here. But as soon as I was in my car, making a U-turn heading home, I was panicking. I was terrified that with my sons grown and living on opposite sides of the coast and my husband traveling without the structure and focus of the classroom, I would fall back into the abyss. I was not doing ECT again. I was not going inpatient. I tried over 20 medications. I did TMS, you name it, I did it. I was 60 years old. I decided as I'm driving home, I knew myself as well as any mental health professional, I needed to come up with a plan. And then I somehow, as I'd been doing my lesson plans, I had seen that Bruce Springsteen was going to be touring in Australia. This was October, in February. So as I'm merging onto the expressway, I remember exactly where I was. I thought, that's it. I'll go to Australia and follow his 2014 High Hopes tour. Now, I have to tell you, I hate to travel. I hate to be alone. And remember, I hadn't known who this guy was a year earlier. But I got home before I even took my coat off or said hello to my dogs. I sat down. I Googled travel agent Australia. I wrote to the first 5. And the next morning, one called me. And within a week, the trip was booked. And that was it. And I'll tell you, I was dreading. And people say, oh, how fun, you're going to see Bruce Springsteen. Well, first of all, I don't do the 3-letter F word, fun. Although the first time I did do it was at a Bruce Springsteen concert. But people, as depressed as I was, you don't think about fun. I mean, I wasn't doing this for fun. I'm not the kind of person who can sit on a couch and say, okay, what am I going to do? I would have just been on the floor. That would have been the end of me if I was sitting alone in my family room on the couch. So I just grabbed onto this and I was terrified. If I could have just disappeared from the world like a wisp and not left anyone sad behind me, I would have preferred that. But I will do anything, as terrifying as it is, if I think it will help me. And this was the only thing I could think of to try to stay upright. And I did not go to change. I did not. But I will tell you, I came home a different person. And when you say, I don't seem like a depressed person. Now, I think I still am depressed. But this transformation that began when I took this trip continues. I'm 72 now. It's continuing to this very day. Because of this trip, I just ended up baby stepping to this life that people say, what would your younger self say about you? And I say, I'm 72. What would my 71-year-old self say if she saw what I'm doing now? I tell my husband, I'm not living my life. This is like someone else's life that I'm living. But it's all baby steps, just right. Baby stepping my way.
What was the reaction, given all you've been through? You must have a very supportive family, particularly your husband, to deal with all of that, all the medications, all of the therapy.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah.
And I taught, actually, one of the chapters in this book, the third one, is in the psychiatric, when I'm the first time I go to the psychiatric hospital. My husband is amazing. And actually, I came, and he's a professor. He was on sabbatical that year. So after I wrote to the travel agent, I called him up. I told him I quit, and I said, but don't worry, I'm not going back to the hospital. I'm going to Australia. And he's a very calm guy. And I said, do you want to go with me? You're on a sabbatical. Do you want to go with me? And he said, I understand why you quit. I understand it was tough. And if you think that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I don't like Bruce Springsteen and I don't like stadium seats. I don't want to go. And actually when he travels a lot, and a month before the trip, so 3 months later, I'm in bed and I'm watching him packing so efficiently and I'm just watching him, and he would do anything for me. This man, you know, it's hard to help a depressed person. So he would take care of whatever physical things he could. So I'm watching him, and all of a sudden, this is a month before the trip, I'm thinking, wait, he would do anything for me. Why isn't he going with me? So I get up out of my bed, and he's 6'3", I was 5'4", and I stand there and I say, Andy, you would do anything for me, but you won't go on this trip with me? Why? And he just looked at me for the second. He goes, okay, I'll go. And then in this frozen moment, as he said that, and I'm staring up at him, he's staring down at me, and I'm imagining the two of us running from one airport to another, and he doesn't like Bruce, and blah, blah, blah. And he's a researcher and he's always working. And I'm thinking, he is going to be so miserable. And I thought, I'm going to have enough trouble taking care of me. I don't want to be worrying about him. And I just said, that's okay, I'll go myself. And that's how this happened.
That's quite the leap. When you think about it in another sense, I'm sure you've thought about it, that how often does a performer have an impact on somebody? And the fact that Bruce Springsteen had that impact on you, a profound impact, where all of a sudden you decided to take chances, to live, to enjoy, to have fun, the three-letter word.
Well, I wasn't going there to enjoy or to have fun. I was just going there for the structure. I wasn't thinking fun. This wasn't a quest. People say it wasn't a quest. It was nothing. It was just a thing to do. Every morning I would get up, I would have these concerts. You know, it was just to give me some structure while I tried to figure out what I was going to do.
Well, does the fun ever come into your life, though?
Well, actually, at his concerts, they come in. And I'll tell
you. That's my point. I rest my case, Your Honor.
Okay. But I didn't think about them when I was in.
No, I get that. But the point is, you still, by doing what you did to have structure, you also inherited fun when you went.
But it was more than fun too, because it wasn't just the fun for me. But he has helped so many people. People get sick, they get in accidents, they listen to his music, and that motivates them to keep going. I mean, I'm just one of so many people. And it's not, for me.
Wait a minute, but you're not just one of so many people. You've written a memoir about it called High Hopes Again. So clearly it's had a major impact on you. Have you communicated with Bruce?
No. I'm a little aunt. And I wrote the memoir because you know what? I went back to school in my mid-40s and I got an MFA in writing, and I would write for papers, but I could never write for myself. If an editor said, I love that tree in your backyard, go write 5,000 words, he'd have them. But if I looked at the tree and thought, wow, I love that tree, I want to write about it, within 2 minutes, I'd be under my desk. But that was the amazing thing about this trip. I did not go to change, but when I came home, it was the first time in my life that I had a positive ball of energy and a story about me that I was proud of, a story I wanted to tell. I didn't know how I was going to tell the story, but then one thing led to another, starting with moving to Chicago with my husband for what was supposed to be 4 months, but I loved it there so much, I stayed 2.5 years, and finding out about this thing called storytelling. I had never heard of storytelling, where you actually stand in front of a mic, open mics. And my dog walker, the first day there in Chicago, I said, what do you do when you're not walking dogs? And she said, I host a storytelling open mic. There's a string of them across the city. And I also tell stories at the Moth. I had never heard of storytelling. I had never heard of the Moth, but I knew I had one story to tell. I had never stood in front of a mic or on a stage, but I forced myself to go to these. I'd never even been to a bar. I forced myself to go to these open mics in the backs of bars and kind of hobble around telling my story. And then a new friend said, you've got to come with me to the Moth. So I went, we get there, and he said, you have to put your name in to try to tell a story. I was terrified, but as I think I made clear, I don't let that stop me. I put my name in. I got called as the 10th and last storyteller of the night. I literally stumbled on the stairs as I was going up the stage. The lights were so bright. I'd never stood on a stage. The lights were so bright, you can't see the audience. But I, as I started talking, I could hear them laughing and gasping. And I told a 5-minute story about Australia. And I won. I won that night story slam. And people were so interested. And they had so many questions that eventually I was able to really fight through this writer's block like I fight through everything. And I have high hopes. And that ended up being my second book. And that's why I wrote, that's how I came to write High Hopes.
So your first one was Maddie, Milo and me.
And yeah. What happened was I was working on this High Hopes, and an editor had it during the lockdown, and it was taking her forever. And a friend of mine kept saying, write about Milo. It was a terrorist dog I, by accident, had adopted. And I don't know anything about dogs, but I didn't have the heart to send him back. It turned out we were the third family in 18 months. Really, he was attacking us. So anyway, she said, you should write about Milo. And I said, I can't write him. I have writer's block. I can't do it. And then I found 50 pages I had written about him 15 years earlier after he died. So I took those. That's all I needed. And I had a beginning, middle, and end. And I thought it seemed like a more straightforward story than High Hope. So I decided to try to get that one out and then go back on to High Hopes, which is what happened.
Is your husband, and I want to talk about him in a second, because you were featured in Newsweek, I believe, for writing about how you met him. And before we get into that, though, was your husband supportive of your writing as well?
Oh, my God. My husband is so supportive of everything. My favorite lines in the book, High Hopes, are in the acknowledgments of the sentences I write thanking my husband.
He's cliche
to say he's my rock, but there's a reason cliches are out there. It's because they do say something. Yes, my husband is so supportive of me.
So how did you meet him? Because that became a whole story.
Yes, well, and one piece we're missing here is right after Maddie, Milo, and Me came out, the publisher said to me, you've got to get on social media to promote Maddie, Milo, and Me. And to me, social media was Facebook. Someone had put me on there 15 years ago. I didn't want to do it. Guess what? Now I'm in New York. Another doc walker comes in. And I say to her, do you know anyone who does social media? So she gave me the name of Arseni. He's a 19-year-old. Now he's 21. Computer science major at CUNY here. She said he did social media for her company. And I now call Arseni Maestro or Steven Spielberg. And we've had 25 viral videos since last November. I have 700,000 followers. And one day he came over and he doesn't tell me in advance what we're going to do, because then I just say, no, I can't do it. So he comes over, he goes, now you're going to tell the story about how you met Andy. And I did. And it went viral. And it was a lot of young people. Like, that's what was what the Newsweek people were so impressed with, was that so many young people responded of the story of a 71-year-old woman. But I found my husband the way I do everything. I'm trying to write a third memoir, and she tried and she tried and she tried. And that's what I used to tell my kids. I wanted them to put that on my tombstone, because that's what I did and that's what I do. And that's how I found my mother, beginning when I was 11, said to me, if you don't marry someone Jewish, I will disown you. Now, I didn't really know what disown meant at that age, but I could tell it wasn't good. And I would picture myself just floating alone in a dark outer space. And then, for reasons I won't go into here, senior year, as I'm finishing my college application, she sends my father, who never talked to me. He threw my beagle puppy down the stairs when I was 7 and killed it. I mean, you know, he was not a guy. And he comes in, he says, your mother tells me you haven't taken math. I'm a senior in high school. I'm like, yeah. And he said, well, if you want us to pay for college, you're going to go to engineering school and major in chemical engineering. And I'm like, Dad, I never got above a C in math or science. Anyhow, so I went to college to major in chemical engineering and to minor in finding a husband. And, I did much better finding the husband than I did with the, and the interesting thing is I let them tell me what to do in terms of studying, but there was this boyfriend I had that I broke up with senior year in college, And I came home and I told my mother, and she said, there's nothing wrong with him. The problem is you're self-destructive. That's why you got rid of Eric. It's your problem, not his. And so after about a month, I decided she was right. It was probably because now I'm a senior, second semester senior, and I don't have any marriage prospects. I decided she must be right. And she was a guidance counselor. She was really smart. I really loved and respected my parents. So I decided, you know what? She's probably right. So I went and got back with him. But another thing she used to tell me was, when your husband turns the doorknob on the door when he comes home from work and you cringe, nothing in your life will make up for that. She had also told me that. And I went to see him and he said something and I saw him and my whole body just tightened. And I broke up with him and I went on to find Andy. But I would be a great coach and help. I don't know how people do it now, but I was really good at that.
And how long have you been married to Andy?
47 years.
So it seems to have worked.
When I came back from Australia, we had a rough 2 years. He had a divorce lawyer. I mean, I was different. And in fight or flight, he just hunkers down, whereas I fight. And anyhow, we had a rough couple of years, but then we worked through it. And because I don't give up. I mean, he would have left, but I really wanted to be married to him, and we did it.
So you worked it out, especially after all those years. That makes sense. I know. When you take these chances because you don't give up, that's a fascinating dynamic when you're depressed, it would seem to me. Most depressed people can't get off the dime. So you're willing to not only try all these medicines that you talked about, all these electroshock therapies that you talked about, your first concert, and you know, when you were not a young adult, you're able to choose to do these things because you don't want to give up. You want to.
I'm a very disciplined person. I'm 72 now, so sometimes my body parts need to I have surgeries. But I work out every single day. And it always makes me feel better. And before I wake up still, I'm so much better. My parents died 5 years ago. That was a big cloud lifted from me. And then, I still wake up the other day, my husband was out of town and he called and it was in the morning. I said, you know what? Everything's good. It's really good. But I just feel like such a loser. And I wake up and I have to say to myself, okay, no, just put that. Just shut your brain down, go eat breakfast, read. I love newspapers. And then I go to work out and I do it every day and every day it helps. But do you know, I feel so bad that I can't believe that I'm going to feel better afterwards. And I really say this to myself. It's crazy. Every single morning as I'm standing there next to the elliptical, I say to myself, look, just view this as an experiment. Just get on and just see what you feel like afterwards. And I always, and of course, I do workouts the way I do everything else. It's 45 minutes. You get on and you're like, oh my God, I can't do 1 minute. How am I going to do 45? So I say to myself, just worry about minute 45. Just worry about that. And I just take it. I really do. I have this whole, and I listened to the same Bruce Springsteen album for 10 years. And I just take it 1 minute. Don't worry about minute 35. Just worry, get yourself to the next minute. And that's kind of how I did it with the depression. And with I was never the depressed mother, you know, whose kids found her in bed. Like I would drop them off at school, go to the Jewish Y and swim a mile because that got my energy up. I'd go home and work. By 2 o'clock or 2 o'clock, I'd be under my desk. I'd go into the basement and get on a step machine or a bike, whatever I was doing then, and get my heart rate up to 148. And then I'd go pick them up and I would feel, and then my kids always gave me energy. But I worked really as hard as I could to try to get energy where I could. But I remember we were supposed to go to a wedding of a colleague of my husband's, and that I couldn't bring myself to get dressed and go. And he went alone and they're really good friends. And I always think about how I couldn't go to this man's. I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't get up and get dressed and go. So it doesn't always work,
Knowing a lot of depressed people, the fact that you're able to do all that, yes, occasionally you're not going to be able to feel that you could get dressed and go to something. But the fact that you're able to accomplish all the other stuff, you're miles ahead of a lot of depressed people.
Well, I don't tell you about all the things I did. And now, another thing I just forgot about, I felt like such a loser. Another thing that this trip changed was I always wanted to be part of a conversation. When my kids were growing up, I felt like such a loser, and they were great kids, high achievers, nice, polite. And my husband, I was proud of all of them. When I would meet a new person, I would just tell them about my kids and my husband, hoping that they would think, well, if I was related to them, I couldn't be the loser I look like.
Reflected glory in a way.
Because I felt like a nothing. Yeah. But then I went on this trip. That's what I mean. I came home. It was the first time I had a story about myself that I was proud of and wanted to tell.
Before I let you go, we only have a minute or two left. What would you like people to take away from reading your book? Again, it's called High Hopes.
That it's never too late to change. It's never, and I don't even mean change. It's never too late to keep trying. And as long as you're open, but you can't just try and go and check off the box. If I'd gone to that concert and go, okay, I'm here, and I'm just going to cross my arms and count the minutes down. But you just go and whatever it is you're in, wherever, even if it's ECT or going to a hospital, I ended up liking the camaraderie at the hospital and the food. You know, just be open. So try. Don't give up, as horrible as it seems. And be open. And sometimes you need to make a connection with other people or get help from other people. You can't always do it yourself. So try, be open and connected and ask people for help.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Ann Abel. She's author of High Hopes. It's a memoir available on Amazon, Barnes Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Ann, you go to AnnAbelAuthor.com, AnnAbelAuthor.com. And of course, you can follow her, and she's got a lot of followers on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. And Ann, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.